With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Cheesemakers from California brought home 29 awards from this year's 2023 annual cheese competition held by the American Cheese Society. The competition was held in Des Moines, Iowa this year, and a total of 1,454 cheese and cultured dairy products were entered into the competition. California cheesemakers won a total of 45 awards, with Real California Cow's Milk Cheeses bringing home 8 first place, 12 second place, and 9 third place awards in this year's judging. California is the second largest cheese-producing state in the nation, responsible for 2.4 billion pounds of cheese in 2021. If you'd like to find out who those winners were, you can visit cheesesociety.org. And now let's get into today's show headlines. A new invasive pest found in California. A fruit fly detection has placed a portion of Los Angeles County under quarantine. More than 20 tau fruit flies have been found in the unincorporated area of Stevenson Ranch near the city of Santa Clarita. This is the first tau fruit fly quarantine ever issued in the Western Hemisphere. According to the California Department of Food and Agriculture, the fly is native to Asia, and it's a serious pest for agriculture and natural resources. It has a very wide host range, including numerous fruits and vegetables, as well as a select range of native plants in California. It is said to have been brought into California by travelers with uninspected produce. Under quarantine, residents are instructed to not move any fruits or vegetables from their property. That, along with a multi-tiered approach, including the use of fly traps and pesticide treatments, will prevent the spread of this invasive species. To learn more and to view a map of the quarantined area, visit cdfa.ca.gov. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
Researchers are working on multiple projects involving tadpole shrimp in rice fields. Rice Farm Advisor Whitney Brim DeForest described some of the areas of study.
So myself and Luis Espino and Ian Greitenberger were working on a collaborative project about tadpole shrimp control in rice, and then also biocontrol of the weeds using tadpole shrimp. So it's funded by the Department of Pesticide Regulation, and it's our first official year, and it's going to go on for a couple more years, but we've got some interesting results in that the tadpole shrimp do actually eat some of the rice weeds. We've got some greenhouse work going on to test basically, you know, which weed species they like, and then also sort of the interaction between the rice and the weeds and seeing what they prefer when they're, you know, all growing at one time. And then Luis has some data about, you know, timing of planting. And so we're going to look at maybe there's a way to time the planting right so that the tadpole shrimp eat the weeds and not the rice, et cetera. And then hopefully give the growers some insight into sort of the interaction between the tadpole shrimp and the weeds in the field.
UCANR's Climate Smart Agriculture Program can provide quite a bit of assistance to producers. Community education specialist Amber Butlin described how they can help growers with CDFA's Healthy Soils program.
We provide assistance to growers ranging from just answering a couple questions here and there if they have a question about the grant or the application process, or we can be as involved as, you know, sitting down with the grower and, you know, working with them through the application itself. And then beyond that, if they are awarded, we can assist with implementation of the practices that they were awarded funds for and the verification on getting what's required through the grant to CDFA. So assisting with soil samples if necessary or geotagged photos and basically being that go-between between the grower and CDFA.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen?
I typically listen here at work from my desk on my way to work in the morning. When we wake up, it goes on the radio.
I can hear a song and be instantly transported back to a time in my life that I enjoy remembering.
I think that's what I like listening to radio for, is just to stay informed on whether it's news, sports, new music, anything.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, it's that time of year when experts scout fields for crop conditions. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says corn is having a rough season in several states.
Our troubled states are mostly in the middle to western part of the Corn Belt. And we have Missouri leading again this week, 39% of the corn crop rated very poor to poor, followed by Illinois at 22%. And then we have a pair of states, Wisconsin and Nebraska, coming in this week, 15% very poor to poor.
And he has a look at the overall corn condition.
Now, in terms of the stage of development for the corn crop, more than two-thirds of the crop silking by July 23rd. The national number is 68%. That is ahead of the five-year average of 65%, also ahead of last year's 58%. But then you break it down to the individual states, and we see quite a discrepancy between the Eastern Corn Belt, where progress is rather slow, and the Western Corn Belt, where things are moving along much more quickly. So just a couple of numbers here. For example, in Ohio, we see corn silking progress 24 percentage points behind the five-year average. We're also at least 15 percentage points behind the five-year average in Michigan and Wisconsin. But then as you shift a little more to the south and west, we see corn silking progress at least 10 percentage points ahead of the five-year average in Illinois, Missouri, and South Dakota.
Rippey has the latest on soybean crop development.
The soybean crop, we see the progress for blooming passing the two-thirds mark during the week to reach 70% nationally by July 23rd. That is ahead of the five-year average of 66% and also ahead of last year's 62%. We see soybeans blooming at least 10 percentage points ahead of the normal pace in Missouri, Illinois, and Tennessee, but more than 10 percentage points behind the average pace in Ohio. 17 percentage points is the number there for soybeans blooming behind the average pace. Pretty much the same thing with soybean setting pods. 35% of the crop setting pods by July 23rd. Five-year average 31%. Last year at this time, 24%.
Here's the progress report on the winter wheat harvest.
We won't have to talk about winter wheat for much longer, as more than two-thirds of the crop harvested by July 23rd. The national number on that date, 68%. We have been dealing with a slower than normal harvest, partly due to thunderstorm activity on the Great Plains. Five-year average pace for winter wheat harvest on July 23rd is 77%. Last year, 76%. Now we have the winter wheat harvest, though, completely finished, done in Arkansas and also in Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas. Our slowest state, no surprise, is Montana, just 2% harvested on July 23rd, behind the five-year average of 11%.
And a look at the rice crop.
Well, it's been a little hotter, a little drier as you move westward into rice country, and that has not affected the condition of the crop at this stage. We are getting late enough in the rice development that a little bit of heat is not going to appreciably harm the crop at this late stage. With that said, we see 76% of the rice in the U.S. rated good to excellent on July 23rd, just 4% very poor to poor. That's an improvement from last week's numbers, 73% good to excellent and 5% very poor to poor, and pretty comparable to this time a year ago when three-quarters of the crop was good to excellent and 3% very poor to poor.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, cattle producers from across the nation are in San Diego this week for the Cattle Industry Summer Business Meetings. One key focus of the conference will be the industry efforts to bolster global demand for U.S. beef, which these efforts are funded in part by the Beef Checkoff Program and USDA's market development programs. U.S. Meat Export Federation President and CEO Dan Hallstrom explains that the Beef Checkoff International Marketing Committee will receive updates from USMEF on promotional activities for U.S. beef, and committee members will help establish marketing priorities for the coming year.
That's really a focus for USMEF, and albeit this meeting is not as big as the winter meeting, it's still an opportune time for USMEF to connect with producers across the country and really to give them an update on what's going on in the international marketplace. Another focus for this meeting is to present at the International Marketing Committee meeting. It's an excellent chance to sit down with the committee, not only give an update on what's going on internationally, but really work on prioritization as we go into the budget time later this year with the operating committee. So it's a good opportunity to sit down and update, but also to brainstorm on where the focuses should be and what specific strategies to increase the value of beef should be followed.
And Hallstrom adds that producers are especially interested in building international demand for underutilized beef cuts and variety meat, which helps maximize carcass value.
One of the key themes that we talk about with our producers at these meetings and we follow every day is maximizing the value of the carcass. It's not only focused on things like chuck rolls and short plates and things like this, but we're also focused upon secondary cuts. So how do we move more round primal meat into some of these Asian markets, for example, which happens to be one of our strategies? You know, how do we move more beef variety meats into these markets? You know, our record exports a year ago, more than 10% of that was variety meats. So really, most of the variety meats are consumed outside the U.S. So this is an opportunity to really talk about how we're focused on the entire carcass and bringing back the maximum amount of value to the U.S. beef production chain.
Again, that was USMEF President and CEO Dan Hallstrom. Now, the Cattle Industry Summer Business Meeting includes leaders representing the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Cattlemen's Beef Promotion and Research Board, the American National Cattlewomen, and the National Cattlemen's Foundation. Learn more at ncba.org. And in a note sent by the National Milk Producers Federation Board Chairman Randy Moody, he noted that dairy farmers nationwide are grateful that USDA is moving forward by including the full scope of NMPS proposal to guide the dairy industry forward in its modernizing the federal milk marketing order system. He noted that there's still a long journey ahead towards modernizing a federal order system that works better for farmers, but NMPF is ready with co-op-led efforts well underway to ensure that we're well prepared for the FMMO hearing that begins next month. Learn more about this on the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
It's another type of recycling on the farm. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Farmers who utilize manure as fertilizer mostly get the aromatic livestock byproduct from their own operations. New data from USDA's Economic Research Service shows most manure applied to U.S. cropland, 78% in fact, comes from animals raised on the same operation. Meanwhile, 14% is purchased and 8% is obtained at no cost from other animal operations. In 2020, manure was applied to about 8% of the 240.9 million acres planted to seven major U.S. field crops. Cotton and peanut producers are the most likely to purchase manure, typically from poultry growers. Among all animal manure types, poultry litter has the highest nutrient content. Animal producers who apply their operations manure to their own crops account for a high portion of manure users on oats, corn, and barley crops, followed by soybean and wheat. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
Antitrust law is concerned with industry situations where a small number of companies could corner the market for a product and, by doing so, gain the power to control price to the detriment of consumers. It's a big issue in agriculture. Farmers often sell to and buy from highly concentrated markets. Recently, the government tried to flex its antitrust muscle in the sugar industry. Recently, the Department of Justice tried to block the purchase of Imperial Sugar Company by the U.S. Sugar Corporation. The government claimed that the combination of the two companies would hurt consumers by reducing competition in the sugar industry, which would lead to higher sugar prices for consumers. The trial court ruled against the government and the appellate court affirmed. The appellate court noted that Imperial had been in financial distress for years and was barely managing to stay in business. The government couldn't prove its case by showing the appropriate product and geographic markets that the acquisition would impact. Antitrust analysis in ag almost always focuses on the impact on consumers of the end product, not on the farmer producer. If an acquisition or merger would not harm consumers, it will likely be approved even if market choices for farmers are reduced and buying power for the companies is enhanced. The impact on sugar producers didn't come up in the recent case. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
There's been considerable controversy and interest over this broad topic covering the whole economy in the last, I'd say, 5 to 8 years.
That matter, according to USDA economic researcher James McDonald, increased concentration of parts of our nation's agribusiness sector and what that might mean regarding reduced market competition and impacts to food retail. It's the focus of a recently released USDA study with research conducted over the past few years. Food retail, along with meatpacking and seeds, were the three areas of study due to what McDonald called striking transformations into highly concentrated categories over the past three decades.
And what we're trying to do is explain those transformations, that is, how those industries became concentrated, and explain the impacts of that concentration.
In addition, there was a look at merger policy. One significant factor regarding increased concentration in various sectors of food and farm.
In food retailing, for example, at present, there's a proposed merger between Albertsons and Kroger, the third and fourth largest grocery chains in the United States. And what we hope to do is outfit our readers with the understanding of what the competition issues might be in that merger and what types of decisions antitrust enforcers might take in evaluating that merger.
So what were some of the findings in the study, particularly from a food retail perspective? In most metropolitan areas, 5 to 6 store chains account for most supermarket sales. While higher concentration in a market in cases can result in higher prices, likewise, in some cases of concentration caused by economies of scale, prices can be lowered as productivity improves. And in food retail, local and regional markets is where competition is most likely to occur. McDonald says all these findings illustrate that concentration and competition,
although concentration has increased, that is, we've gone to fewer but larger producers in many sectors, the complexity here is that that doesn't always represent a reduction of competition. It does in many cases, but not always. And as a result, we need to be careful in evaluating what a change in concentration might mean for the nature of competition in an industry. And that's, in a sense, why we've got a big report on it, because it's not a simple story.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
think yesterday's action in the grain trade has more positive aspects than negative. I'm Mark Oppold with today's Bottom Line Report brought to you by Helena. Hot weather with very little rain in key areas of the Midwest and Plains, Russian bombing continuing in Danube grain terminals, and end users covering late summer and fall needs, keeping a lot of support under corn, soybeans, and wheat. And yesterday, a good example in our view. Just a small correction in corn and soybeans after the run-up we've seen, and a turn higher in wheat shows there's more upside potential for all three. So we'll watch December corn holding $5.50 or better today, November soybeans holding $14, and we think we've already seen the low for the week, Kansas City September wheat. This is the Bottom Line Report. We see live cattle and feeder cattle futures near lows that should attract buyers, especially if futures start lower today. Wholesale pork starting the day, the highest since August 22nd of last year. That's our Bottom Line at midweek. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for Agnet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. So this recipe right here, I've been getting lots of requests on Instagram and on Facebook Messenger. And somebody wants to know how to make potato chips. Now, remember this. Potato chips is something that we've eaten so many times. But have we ever had a real potato chip, one that's done with elegance and just fresh ingredients? Because it's really, really not that hard. And I'm going to tell you all right now, this is a simple and awesome way to make really fresh and delicious potato chips. So let's get untamed. So the very first thing we're going to be doing is we're going to be using a russet potato chip. Now, I've done this before with the different kinds of potatoes, but I will say this, the one that yields the best crisp is a russet potato. I do not know why. Maybe because of the starch content in the potato is second to none, whereas the regular Yukon Gold potato is a waxy potato, so it doesn't have as much starch in it as a russet potato. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to get our potatoes. We're going to give them a really, really great rinse. Very, very important. And then we're going to pad them down dry. I'm going to slice these really, really thin using a mandolin. Now, if I wanted to give a precise dimension, I would say about an eighth of an inch thick is what we're looking for when we're slicing these. We want this to be very, very thin. If you could go thinner than that, be my guest, but I will tell you right now, it definitely works that way. Now, what I'm going to be doing is pre-cooking my potatoes in a steamer, and I'm going to cook them for 1 hour at 193 degrees Fahrenheit. This is important because this is going to make sure our potato is fully cooked, and all we're doing realistically now is just getting it and crisping it up. Now, when we make French fries, it's the same thing. We pre-cook on a very low temperature, fully cooking, letting them come to room temperature, cooling them. And then all I'm going to do is put a little bit of cornstarch over the top of this potato, and I'm going to fry it. And I'm going to fry it at 350 degrees. Now, I know normally everyone's like 375 is your normal fry temperature, and it definitely is. But with fresh potatoes, we want to keep them from getting super, I don't want to say burnt, but the potato will get very, very dark. And if we just put them at a little bit, you know, 25 degrees lower and keep them in there for about a good 4 to 6 minutes, we're going to get a beautiful cooked potato with lots of great flavor. And once they come out, I'm just going to hit it with some salt, pepper, a little bit of chive. And if you have a blackening spice, a little bit of dust over that works really, really well. This is so great with caviar, with creme fraiche, or just having fresh potato chips for the family, especially my son. My kids love these chips right here. It's so easy to make them and serve them immediately. And when you take them out of the fryer, make sure to put down a paper towel or something to catch all that excess oil. I'm Albert J., the Untamed Chef for Agnet West.
Green space, the final frontier of health and wellness. You think you can make a case for that being true?
Yes.
Yes, that very enthusiastic yes comes from Michelle Kondo. She is a research social scientist with the U.S. Forest Service. And Michelle, then what wild and rugged place are you stationed?
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia. Well, I guess that could be a little wild and rugged during football season. Turns out the Forest Service has its Northern Research Field Office in Philly, helping northern cities deal with issues around urban forestry, trees, and green spaces. And Michelle studies, among other things, how people relate to trees and green spaces and how those natural resources affect our physical and mental health. First, on the physical side, researchers took a look at about 9 million people long-term, seven cities around the world, matching up their addresses with what kind of green spaces were nearby, and they looked at those people's birth and death records. Results were conclusive.
People live longer when they live in greener environments. With a greener neighborhood, your risk of premature mortality goes down.
Michelle and her colleagues have done some studies that give us at least a clue as to why people seem to live longer in areas with trees and greenery. Michelle says Philadelphia has a lot of vacant lots and such, which can be not only very ugly, but sometimes dangerous. So with that in mind,
we asked a set of residents to wear heart rate monitors and to walk around their neighborhood. We asked them to walk twice, both before and after some of the vacant lots had been cleaned up and we planted some trees and grass. And we found their heart rates were significantly lower when they were in view of these greened vacant lots.
And of course, it's probably some sort of mental or emotional reaction, which brings us to another study that Michelle did.
We measured people's moods, emotions. We sort of tracked their location throughout their day, and they would receive little pop-up messages on their phones to answer our very brief survey about their mood or emotion.
And the results when people were near or around trees and such?
Positive emotions were improved and negative emotions decreased compared to, for example, if they were indoors or not somewhere near some trees.
Trees. You know, I bet that would be true of dogs. You know, they always feel better, I think, with a couple of trees, you know, around for...
Right.
But that's hopefully got nothing to do with the fact that most of us are healthier and happier when we're near or around trees and such. In fact, Michelle says we don't really know exactly why that is. Is it that trees clean the air or make summer temperatures lower, or that trees reduce stressful noise levels in urban areas? Michelle, I bet you'd be a lot happier if you could have the resources to find the answers to those questions.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot happier. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Our friend Cindy Zimmerman over at agwired.com was there at the first Women in Ag Tech meeting. She had an opportunity to talk with Dr. Karen St. Germain of NASA. Let's take a listen to their conversation.
First of all, if you would introduce yourself for me.
Sure. I'm Dr. Karen St. Germain, and I run Earth Science for NASA.
Well, you were here to talk to the first Women in Ag Tech live in-person meeting. And first of all, how did you feel like being here?
Well, it's an honor to be here for the inaugural event, and really energizing to see all of these women coming together, tackling challenges that we all face, that humanity faces, and doing it in a way that is inviting the next generation to roll up their sleeves and get involved with us.
Well, it's eye-opening for some to find out the role that NASA plays in agriculture. What are some of the main points that you hit on here with this, to tell them what you do as far as agriculture is concerned?
Well, you know, agriculture has been one of the oldest constituencies of NASA Earth. You know, we launched our first agriculture-focused satellite in the 70s amid a major food crisis, and that was the Landsat mission. But since then, we've really upped our game. We're observing not just the land and land change, but also precipitation, the global climate, and the way all of that is changing. And what we're hoping to do is give producers headlights, in fact, high beams, to see what's coming.
And you, I mean, you tend to, you work with a lot of agencies that producers know, but you work behind the scenes, and they may not know that your work is being used to give them information.
That's right. And we work with partners to amplify the impact of NASA science because, of course, we think the science itself is awesome. And it is. But it doesn't reach its full potential until it's out into the hands of people who can use it. And working with other government agencies or universities and extension programs, these are all partnerships that amplify the impact of our work.
Well, you are also here, while you're here, you're on a tour, and you're talking with a lot of ag groups and farmers even. So tell us about that.
Yeah, the idea is that we get together with commodity groups, individual farmers, university extension programs, and even some of the big tech companies to really understand how our work can help advance what they're doing. And you don't get that without spending some time in conversation, understanding what challenges they have, and talking through what we might be able to do to help, and then trying some things. So a lot of what I want to get out of this week is the ideas and the seeds for projects that we'll go try, because NASA's a science agency, but my favorite thing about NASA is we're a learning agency. We want to learn, and we want to help others learn.
How do you feel about a woman in technology? You talked about, you know, the percentages generally of women in the room in any particular role that you've played over the years. But how do you said you felt energized looking at this group here. But how do you feel about the role of women in technology in general going forward?
You know, I think the role of women in agriculture, in technology, in these critical undertakings, you can't overstate it. You can't overstate the importance of having women in the room. And that's because women bring a different perspective. They bring different questions. They bring different experience and expertise. And that's the key to excellence. You know, in my world, in science, the quality of the science is all about the quality of the questions you ask. And when we have diversity in our teams, when we have women at the table, we ask better questions.
That's a great interview. I know there's other people here who want to grab you before you run out, but anything else you want to add before we stop?
Well, it's just it's a thrill to be here for the inaugural event, and I'm looking forward to a very long collaboration.
All right. Well, great to meet you here, Karen. Thank you very much here at the Tech Hub Live event in Des Moines. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. California consumes nearly all U.S. renewable diesel. California accounts for nearly all renewable diesel consumption in the United States. That's according to data released last week by the U.S. Energy Information Administration. California's consumption of renewable diesel was more than 8 times the amount produced there in 2021. Instead, most of California's renewable diesel was produced in other states or it was imported. California's renewable diesel consumption grew substantially after its low-carbon fuel standard went into effect back in 2011. Between 2011 and 2021, consumption grew from 1 million barrels to 28 million barrels per year, over 18 times its original volume. 6 states, including Louisiana, North Dakota, California, Wyoming, Washington, and Kansas, accounted for all renewable diesel production in the United States in 2021. Many of the plants in other states have exclusive agreements to send all of the renewable diesel they produce to distributors in California. U.S. renewable diesel production capacity could more than double by 2025, boosting domestic production. NAFB contributed to that report.
An avocado field day is coming up next month at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. The free seminar for avocado growers will be taking place on Wednesday, August 2nd, beginning at 9 a.m. The workshops being made possible by the California Avocado Society, California Avocado Commission, and UC Cooperative Extension. Organics Director for the Grimm Family Center for Organic Production Research at Cal Poly, Matt Grishup, will be going over organic certification, and Cal Poly Orchard Manager Johnny Rosecrans will be providing information on irrigation and fertilizer injectors. Other topics of discussion will include biocontrol of pests and healthy soils, as well as a presentation on the UCR Advanced Rootstock Selection Trial taking place at Cal Poly. The event is free, but registration is required by July 31st. More information about the field days available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
So far this year, only 1/4 of typical U.S. acreage has burned in wildfire. Put another way, in 2023, almost 875,000 acres have burned to date versus the 10-year average at this time of under 3.5 million.
Because we had such an abundant, bounteous wet season across the West, it has taken a few extra weeks for things to start drying out, especially in the higher elevations.
But USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says with multi-week extreme heat in the southwest quadrant of the country and that high pressure now covering much of the West.
Across the Southwest, we have seen a small explosion of wildfires, notably uptick in the Southwest in certainly the last week or two.
Likewise, wildfire activity has also begun in parts of the interior Pacific Northwest.
So even though things are getting off to a little bit later than normal start, we still do expect to see an active wildfire season for the late summer period across much of the western United States.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Some good reasons to support urban agriculture. Deputy Agriculture Secretary Jotil Torres-Small says that supporting a more geographically diverse agriculture would make for a more resilient agricultural system.
Agriculture can happen anywhere. And I was in Michigan last year talking with some urban farmers who had really struggled to find land and also to find markets. And what we've learned and what Secretary Vilsack talks a lot about is for a system to be resilient, we need to serve everyone, not just the few, but also the many. And what that means is making sure that if you want to get into agriculture, we can help find ways to make that easier. And part of that is going to be urban agriculture.
The Waters Advocacy Coalition this week sent recommendations to the Environmental Protection Agency and Army Corps of Engineers regarding the final Waters of the United States rule as it relates to the Supreme Court decision in Sackett v. EPA. Courtney Briggs, American Farm Bureau Federation Senior Director of Government Affairs, says the coalition is a multi-industry alliance based in Washington, D.C.
We have about 45 trade organizations that represent a large portion of the national economy. We are everything from farming and agriculture to construction to manufacturing, energy development, transportation infrastructure, and recreation. So we cover a large gamut of the national economy.
The letter outlines the recommendations the coalition would like to see in a new WOTUS rule.
The agencies have stated that they intend to make surgical fixes, and it appears that the agencies will forego public comment and stakeholder engagement and take the rule that they finalized earlier this year and simply strike language from the rule related to significant nexus as well as the definition of adjacency. So we are simply reminding the agencies that that is not a defensible response to Sackett or an appropriate approach to the rulemaking.
Briggs expects a new final rule within a couple of months.
The agencies are using their good cause exemption to bypass the formal rulemaking process, which will allow them to finalize this rule at lightning speed. So they have said that they will have a finalized rule complete before September 1st. And our fear is that the agencies aren't going to make all the necessary changes to ensure that this rule respects the holding in Sackett.
Michael Clements, Washington.
Heat stress symptoms to watch out for. Dee Jepson, an Ohio State University Ag Health and Safety professor, says sometimes your skin will give you the first clue that you may be suffering from heat stress.
Heat cramps, which is whether that's in your legs, your arms, or your stomach. And really what's happening when our bodies are cramping, it's the loss of body salt through the sweat. And that causes the water to rush into our muscles. And that results in our cramps and our spasms that we get.
In addition to that, can be muscle cramps.
If you get a heat rash or any type of prickly or blistery parts of the skin, that's showing that your sweat glands have become clogged, your sweat glands are inflamed, and the sweat cannot evaporate from your body in these conditions.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.